You're listening to Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the curtain at Lyric Opera of Chicago. Backstage at Lyric features in-depth interviews with the singers, conductors, and creative minds behind the productions in the 2007-2008 season. For additional interactive content and to order tickets, visit us online at lyricopera.org.
Soprano Christine Brewer and bass Franz Havlata are backstage at Lyric.
So it is, you know, that sort of thing that, you know, men are from Mars and women are from Venus. You can see them saying things and they just about sometimes make a connection, and then it just goes off on another tangent, and it's very real.
Thank you for downloading this episode of Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes of one of the world's great opera companies. I'm Roger Pines of Lyric Opera of Chicago. In this episode, it's my pleasure to speak with two of today's most celebrated singers of the operas of Richard Strauss. In the new production of Strauss's Die Frau ohne Schatten at Lyric this season, Franz Havlata is returning to the company as Barak, and Christine Brewer is making her Lyric debut as the Dyer's wife. They're both singing their roles for the very first time. Before we play the interview, here's a brief synopsis of the opera. In a mythical land, the emperor rules with his empress, who's the daughter of Kaikobad, the spirit king. Kaikobad's messenger brings the empress's nurse a message. If the empress fails to procure a shadow, that is, conceive a child, in 3 days, the emperor will be turned to stone. The emperor departs for a 3-day hunting expedition, leaving his wife desperate. At the nurse's suggestion, she and the empress descend to the human world to find a woman who will sell her shadow to the empress. They find the restless and unhappy wife of Barak the Dyer. The wife has no desire for children, although her husband wants them. The nurse tempts the wife with visions of luxury, which will be hers if she yields her shadow. The wife denies her husband their marriage bed for 3 days, during which the nurse and the empress are their servants. After much emotional agony, the empress realizes that the cost to other human beings in gaining another shadow is too high. Her innate goodness earns her a shadow, saves her husband's life, and brings the reconciliation of Barak and his wife. The opera ends with both couples ecstatically proclaiming their wish to contribute to the continuation of humanity through children. Now, on to the interview with Christine Brewer and Franz Havlata. I hope you enjoy it. I'm here with Franz Havlata and Christine Brewer, who are Barak and his wife in our production of Die Frau ohne Schatten at Lyric. Now, before this Frau, had you ever sung together, the two of you?
Yes, we have.
Oh, what did you do together?
We did, I think the first time we sang together was at Covent Garden. We did Giovanni, probably 95. Mm-hmm. And we've done a Mahler 8 together. We've done
Schubertiade.
Yes.
Together.
You did a Schubert recital together?
Yeah.
That must have been great.
In Wigmore Hall.
Yes.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
Now, you're scheduled to do this piece together again.
We are. Right? If Franz doesn't kill me before we do it, because, you know, that nagging wife thing maybe gets old.
If it happens by accident, of course.
Yes. Now, Christine, this is your Lyric debut.
It is.
Yes, but you're actually an Illinois girl.
I am, yes. I grew up in Grand Tower, Illinois.
Which is where?
It's very far south. It's almost on the tip of the state on the Mississippi River. But we would say Grand Tower. But it's Grand Tower. And I live in Lebanon, Illinois, which is just across the river from St. Louis.
Did you tell me that you went from a town of 500 to a town of...
3,500. So I'm in a big city now.
So, Franz, you're from Bavaria, right?
Yes. I live 20 minutes from Richard Strauss's birthplace.
Truly?
Yes, I do.
His birthplace was...
Garmisch-Partenkirchen.
So, what is it like to sing Strauss in Munich, where they consider him their own? I mean, you have sung...
The problem is, you know, the Viennese were a little quicker. They consider him their own. Actually, he's always, by many people, meant to be a Viennese composer. He's not. Of course, he's a Bavarian composer, and I'm very proud of that. It's, of course, cool. I know the Strauss family. They have a festival there, the Richard Strauss Festival, where I've sung a lot. And actually, that's the biggest composer I'm dealing with. I'm like three quarters of my work is Richard Strauss, so
truly.
I'm really related to that kind of.
Does that mean that when you sing a Strauss role in Munich, do people get up and say, it's supposed to be like this, because they know it so well?
No, they don't.
Oh, good.
No, they don't. They only, that happens only with Wagner in Bayreuth. No, it does. No, they don't do that. They love it. They had a hard time the last 15 years because Peter Jonas, the general manager in Munich, he didn't like Strauss. So he didn't put on a lot of Strauss, and everyone was really pissed off because they said, we want to hear our composer. And now it starts again to get, so soon we'll meet maybe in Munich and do a lot of Strauss together because they put on all the Strauss again.
Now, Christine, this is your first Dyer's wife.
It is, yeah.
Francis, this is your first Baroque also.
Yes.
Oh, my. were these roles in any way goals for the two of you? Were you, I mean, did you have these in the back of your mind for a while, or did they come to you sort of suddenly suggested by someone else?
This one kind of came to me suggested by several people over the past probably 10 years. People have said, oh, you know, this is something you should look at. And I sort of put it on the back burner until I was made this offer to come here and to come to Paris. So, so for a few years I've been sort of thinking of this one.
I see. Now, Franz, did you have Baroque as a goal?
Yeah, I always wanted to sing it. I love it. It's great. It's one of the nicest parts written for a male voice, I would say. And I always wished to sing it, but I started off as a low bass, and I thought, I might never do it. And then I looked in the history books, and I noticed that the first ox was the first Baroque.
First ox in Rosenkavalier.
The first ox in Rosenkavalier by Richard Strauss. His first performance was the same singer as Baroque, and Johanan, by the way. And I thought, oh, if he could do it, maybe I can do it too. And actually, it was my suggestion when I was here for Flying Dutchman a couple of years ago. It was my wish and suggestion, and we were looking for a piece which I could do here. And I said, okay, I'm going to try this here.
So, Christine, for you, you had come to this after singing other Strauss roles. Was it a sort of natural progression that you would move into this one?
Yeah, I think so. The first one I did, of course, was Ariadne, and I've sung that probably more than any role I sing, and then Ägyptische Helena, and Chrysotomus, and so this is sort of the progression, I think.
There's no way beyond that, because that is the,
hardest
ever written part for a female voice, I think. So the next one will be a decathlon or something, I don't know.
The last time, Franz, you were here, there you were on our stage as Baranox, which is one of the great comic parts, and Baroque couldn't be more different from that. So which character is closer to who you are, do you think?
I hope Baroque.
Oh!
I hope Baroque is closer. No, I'm... You know, I have a very strange mixture in my blood. I'm half Bohemian, half Bavarian, so I've got both sides in me. Bohemians are very funny, witty, and musical, kind of open-minded people, but they also have this slight depression side on their souls. So I think I've got all two of them, and whatever I need is coming out, I think. But what I really find great about this profession is just playing a comic role, then playing Wozzeck, then playing Leporello, and then do that's the diversity. That's what's really thrilling me and what's keeping me kind of alert in this job.
Does he have any phrase in the whole role that isn't beautiful? It's such a beautiful role.
No, he doesn't. Every time he's coming, time is standing still, and it's just the most beautiful music in the world.
Now, the Dyer's Wife, on the other hand, has a lot of really aggressive...
It is. It is very angular sort of writing, especially for the first two acts. And then in the third act, then she also sings more the lyrical melodies with her husband, but the first and the second act especially, very angular, very harsh. And I mean, we've been talking about it in rehearsals, and you know, I mean, everyone says, oh well, she's just, you know, she's a shrew, she's
nagging,
always in a bad mood, she's nagging and everything. But I have to also say, I think if you look at her situation, you would also understand why she is this way, because she's stuck in this very poor life, that she's not only, you know, a housewife taking care of her husband and cooking and everything, but she's also got his three brothers who are like the Three Stooges, you know, and so she's...
Handicapped brothers. They are handicapped, too.
One-eyed, one-armed, and hunchback.
Yes. And they're just very annoying to her. And so, I mean, of course she's going to be nagging if she has that life every day.
Now, I wanted to talk really about this relationship, which is the most interesting one in the opera by far. What... Other than the fact that she has these brothers to deal with, what's the problem in this relationship ultimately?
It was funny. I almost said this yesterday in rehearsal when we were sitting in a sort of a semicircle talking about it. And I said, I feel like we're in marriage counseling because I think the biggest problem for them is the lack of communication. She says things. She assumes that he should understand exactly why she's upset. And when he doesn't understand it and then goes off on another tangent... It's very frustrating for her, but she's not always very clear. So it's both. I have to say it's a two-way street.
I think the whole piece is about the relationship of man and woman. We have two couples, which is very interesting. We've got this kind of very noble, very kind of psychoanalytic, Sigmund Freudian couple of the emperor and the empress. And then we got this down-to-earth, everyday kind of big conflict of men and women, and I think he just can't imagine someone doesn't want to live this life. That's Barak's problem. So he hasn't got this perspective. He just, the next day is the next worry, you know, he has. Mm-hmm. And she is always thinking about how could we go on, how could we kind of improve ourselves, how we could. So, but this is a way of thinking. He just, and that's basically, I think, a big problem in many relationships between men and women, that a woman is always kind of looking forward to see new, to kind of go up to new rivers, and men just try to secure what they have. And that's a big problem. That's the source of big fights.
Well, and also, I mean, there are moments in here that seem, you know, to me... ridiculous when I've just said how you know, this, everything is wrong, everything's horrible, and he says, well, you know, why aren't we having children? You know, it's like, what do you mean? Why aren't we, you know, you want to have children? What the hell? I mean, we've got these three brothers that we're dealing with, and you've got this very difficult life, and it's sort of like, oh, well, that'll solve our problems. Let's have a baby. Oh, okay. So it is, you know, that sort of thing that, you know, men are from Mars and women are from Venus. You can see them saying things, and they just about sometimes make a connection, and then it just goes off on another tangent, and it's very real.
Now, there's another thing, too. He's way too sweet. He tries to understand. He's a little slow, maybe. He tries hard to understand it, mm-hmm. but he doesn't know what she's talking about. So, and very strangely, he just bursts out once, and he erupts once in this piece and really screams at her, mm-hmm. takes a sword and wants to kill her. And from this moment on, this relationship works. Mm-hmm. And this is the strangest thing. This is a little easy, maybe, put, but maybe that's right, because he gets a killer.
But I think it is for her when she sees suddenly that he is strong and he's making a decision, even though it's a violent decision that he wants to kill her, but throughout those first two acts he sort of never makes a solid decision and says, and this is sort of the first time she sees him maybe very strong, and it's a turn on, or it's, you know, I mean, it's sort of
I think it
entices
is.
Her then, you
and,
know,
and she doesn't she say to him, kill me
go
if
ahead.
You want to
yeah.
Now, do you think that's believable, that suddenly he erupts in this way?
It might be a little exaggerated, but in the basics, I think it's absolutely believable. Mm-hmm. I know relationships like this, mm-hmm. where a man or a woman, the other way around, it could mm-hmm. be the other way around as well, a man tries to be soft, tries to understand, tries to be communicative, tries to be whatever, and the woman expects something completely different. And once they do it, it's a huge surprise. And from then on, this relationship works. I saw couples like this, where you just, there is something like to be too understanding and not selfish enough. She wants him to be selfish. She wants mm-hmm. to be kind of also overwhelmed by him, or...
Yeah, well, she gives him lots of opportunities also to be strong And then when he doesn't, it's so frustrating for her.
He doesn't answer aggression with aggression.
Yeah,
that's the problem.
Doesn't she say to him at one point, we've been married for 2.5 mm-hmm. years and I now have lost the desire to have children? Where does that whole thing come from? You think she really did want them at one time?
Well, probably, you know, but then this life is so hard. And poverty and sort of this sort of oppression, it's so hard. Why would she want to bring a child into this life, you know?
So what is going on then in this wonderful scene that the two of them have at the opening of the third act, which is, I think, the most thrilling music in the entire opera, mm-hmm. where they are divided, where they're on two sides of a wall and neither one knows that the other mm-hmm. is there. And what is that about? Those words are so significant for both of them. What are they singing about there?
I'm singing, mir anvertraut, dass ich sie hege schoß. So my wife is given to me, that I protect her and I shelter her because of her young, innocent heart. And it's the biggest declaration maybe ever made in opera. And the most moving thing, it was just said, the most moving thing, he doesn't say it to her. He says it to himself, which is so moving. And she does too.
You're singing it too.
Yeah, and it is just, you know,
is a great dramaturgic trick too by Hofmannsthal, that they don't they never come close to each other. Mm-hmm. It's everyone's thought, single thought. And that makes the whole thing even more moving, mm-hmm. because there are a lot of love duets where you hold my hand and we sing for a while together. But this is completely different. This is the street. He shows the street in which this could go. And the desire of every single person mm-hmm. in this marriage.
It sounds like you're both of the opinion that what is going on between these two people is applicable to modern life in a big way.
Oh, yeah.
I think so, our lives in this definitely are.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you look around, you see. Mm-hmm. You know, in Germany we have now 85% rate of divorce. So it doesn't work. Out of certain reasons, it doesn't work. So that is actually a big, big, big kind of essay on why does a marriage not work and how do you get it working. So I think at the end there's two conclusions, a very positive one for the down-to-earth people and a very negative one for the emperor and empress, because they are looking for something they would never get. You know that the cross of these two couples is, so the empress goes down and looks for some, What is manhood? What is real human beings? I was always held in a golden cage. I want to see what human love is really like. So that's why she comes down to earth. And I think Hofmannsthal at the end says that it's easier for an earthy couple to imagine what happens in heaven than for a heavenly couple to imagine what happens on earth. And that this is a very positive, very kind of encouraging conclusion mm-hmm, to this piece, mm-hmm. I think.
It sounds like the two of you didn't have such major difficulties thinking yourselves into these characters.
Mm. We are which both I think married.
We're both married. And if my husband were here, he would probably say there's probably a lot of the Dyer's wife in me. That's why I think I sympathize with her, because I've been married. I just had my 30th anniversary this summer. We were very young when we got married. We were in college, you know, and I was 21. We were kids when we got married. We sort of grown up together. But there are times that you feel like the communication just goes haywire. And sometimes my husband says to me, I think you just need a fight. You want a fight. I can tell by the way you're talking to me, you would just like
to
have a fight.
Provoke a fight.
Yes. And I know that that's part of my personality. And so I'm sort of drawing upon that.
I think it's part of every relationship. Yeah. So you have to be ready for the fights.
Right.
And you have to stand up for the fights.
Right.
Not escape. And that's the big mistake Barak is doing at the beginning, which is, mm-hmm. it's not by bad will. He's just a very good man. Mm-hmm. And he hates fighting. He wants to sit down with her, have dinner, and afterwards go to bed and have a nice time. That's mm-hmm. what he wants to. Mm-hmm. But it's not this easy. And That, I mean, please, that is a real very, very modern and now up-to-date version of marriage, isn't it?
Do you think, as you're playing him, do you want to shake him and say, stand up for yourself and get some backbone? And
no, as Christine says, I understand his personality as well. Mm-hmm. I understand his personality. I'm a man, you know? I'm a man and I think like a man and I know what he's thinking. Actually, what you have to be very careful when you play this character is not knowing the end. If you play the end at the beginning, it gets kind of kitschy and it gets soft. You just need to play it as if you don't know what's happening in the next scene. And then this character gets vivid. Otherwise, it gets heavy, boring. He must be young and still full of ideas, but his ideas are so different from hers. That's the problem.
Christine, the first time we talked about this, you said that you were fascinated by the fact that she has no name.
Yes, yes. Yeah, but again, I mean, that's, again, this sort of cultural thing, you know, that, you know, she's just the helpmate. She's the, I'm helping with the dying, I'm keeping the house. I mean, certainly, from my grandmother's generation, you know, that was, and not so much my mother's too, but I mean, certainly I remember my grandmother sort of, that was her life. I mean, she was Mrs. Craig. She was her husband's name, you know, I mean, she took her husband. So I think that is sort of the...
That's one explanation. The other one is, I mean, the emperor doesn't have a name.
Well, no one really has a name. Yeah.
The only one who has a name is Barak.
Yeah.
So what do you conclude out of that? I think the Dyer's wife is an idealistic figure. The emperor is a very idealistic figure. And the empress, of course, she is actually the Freud or Jung incarnation, because she says everything what Sigmund Freud and Jung afterwards kind of wrote down. And the center and the real down-to-earth figure is Barak. And everything is turning around his house. Mm-hmm. So I think that's why he has a name, because you need some kind of post. The whole drama is kind of circling. And all the others are kind of ideas. They are not as wide as possible. You don't want to put the name on it, a label on it. That you have to leave it as free as possible, I think. That's the idea of Afonso.
Getting back to the music, Christine, I know you sing a lot of Strauss songs. You've recorded them too. Do they have anything to do with the kind of singing that you're doing in Frau, or is this a totally, radically different Strauss?
There are certainly bits of this that I say, oh, that sounds a little bit like Giptische Helena, or that sounds a little like something I've sung. You know, I hear different things, but I have to say, you know, for me, the way I had to learn this was to sing it as the same way I would have sung something like the four last songs. You know, I have to, especially on the angular sort of music, technically, I couldn't just start punching out those notes. I had to sing
what
it.
What everyone usually does, which I hate.
I just had to sing it very lyrically, but that's the way I approach everything, period, the end. And then it evolves with the character, and then hopefully then it sounds the way it's supposed to sound, but it's not going to just be bombastic punch, punch, punch. And we talked about how Paul Curran, our director, was saying the other day, a lot of it's not so much her screaming, but sort of holding it in. Yeah. So I'm not going to let loose now. So I don't think, and it's also so very boring, I think, when you go and you hear just all loud, loud, loud screaming, screaming.
I always compare it to an onion, her music. It's like seven layers, and every once in a while you get to the core of it, and then it gets so incredibly beautiful. Mm-hmm. And out of this seven layers emerges the most unbelievable, and she's got the most unbelievable lines, you know, of like sheer beauty, always loud. She's only loud when it's really getting beautiful. All the rest is very much diction and character, but very beautiful singing, as she says. I mean, I can't imagine that anyone at Strauss's time screamed it the way a lot of her colleagues did in this part. I don't believe it. It must have been different, because Richard Strauss would have killed them, I think.
The first time we talked about Strauss, Christine, you said that a lot of his music can be so beautiful that it hurts. I mean, we talked about the third act duet. Is there much more of that in this piece.
Yeah, I mean,
end of the first act.
Oh, that some of these orchestral things at the end of that first act, it's just heart-wrenching. It's so beautiful.
What is going on that prompts this music at the end of the first act?
There's this big fight going on, and she screams at him again, and he turns around and says, "Even if you are strange, you know, I always will love you." And he's all on his own, and then the guards of the city come and sing about how the most important thing in to keep our society or our little city together is the love of men and women. And he listens to that, and this is the most unbelievable. It's like a church choral. Mm-hmm. And then she comes, and they have this...
We have a lot of moments where we're not even saying...
They only understand each other when they don't talk.
Yes. It's yeah, yeah.
So that's a nice thing in this production. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of glances. Mm-hmm. And
What sort of thing is Paul Curran actually asking you to do in terms of movement? Is it just very sort of, you know, whatever a Dyer and his wife would do in any era of history? Or is it very modern, what he's asking you for?
Now. Not modern, now.
Just, yeah.
People from now.
Yeah.
But I always do this. I can't act differently. I can't act like an actor from 200 years ago. I'm an actor who lives in our time.
Now, so does she. Yeah. In the piece, at one point, well, I think it's the end of the first act, the marriage bed is supposed to be split, right?
Yeah, well... Yeah.
No, he's thrown out.
He's thrown out of the house.
Yeah. Not only of the bed, he's thrown out of the house.
Yeah, the bed is out on the porch, and I say, you know, here's your dinner, and you know, I'm going to bed. And by the way,
fortunately, it's in Indonesia, not in Michigan.
Are there any? Are you involved in any of the special effects in the show?
Yes. What,
such as
the sword?
Yeah.
What's going on with the sword?
I got a sword falling from the heaven.
It literally falls from that?
To kill her.
Wow.
And there's all the magic that comes out of the fire pot that I'm cooking over for most of the first act, you know. And this is where the apparition of the beautiful young man comes out, you know. And it's really beautiful. I think this is going to be gorgeous.
The apparition of the young man comes
out of the fire.
Yeah, out of the fire.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah, and he's all wrapped up in silk the first time I see him, and the dancers unwrap him, sort of like a maypole, unwrapping this beautiful, gorgeous man. Plus, there are other dancers on the stage, too, and you know, the nurse is sort of having each one's scarf taken off their faces, and each one is more beautiful than the next, but then the one that's come out of the fire pot is gorgeous. And
she still likes me, eh?
I do. Yeah.
We should explain to our listeners the young man is there because...
Well, this is part of the deal. You know, if I will sell my shadow, look what all you can have. You can have any young man. You can
to
have...
To the Empress, by the way.
Yes. If I would sell my shadow to the Empress, they promised me all these things. And so she's just showing me some of the possibilities. And she's given me this beautiful tiara and this beautiful scarf, you know. And it's sort of, I've never had any of these beautiful things in my life. And then when these men start coming in with these silk things all around them, and it's a little...
She gets crazy.
Yes. And that's one of her most beautiful lines comes out of that scene.
Yeah.
You both do roles that really take absolutely everything that you have to give, it seems to me. I mean, Christine, you just did your first Brunhilde in Goethe Dämmerung, and Franz, you just sang Hans Sachs at Bayreuth. At this point, you both have so many demanding roles in your repertoire, but you both, it seems to me, have been careful about when you've taken the big roles on. Now, this business of opera, it's a business where if you want a long career, you have to teach yourself to say no pretty early on when people are offering you stuff that you don't think you're ready for yet. So just thinking about this side of an operatic career, was that difficult, or have you always been able to say to people, maybe that's for 10 years from now, but it's not for right now?
I think I'm pretty good about doing that. I think I'm pretty good. If I err, I probably err on the side of maybe not taking something soon enough. I mean, I probably would be the type that would say, you know, I'm going to wait a couple years on that. But I don't think it's hurt me, because I feel that my voice is healthy and
oh, yeah.
And so I think it's a good thing. I mean, there's plenty of time. I mean, if you sing with a good technique, you should be singing your whole life. And that's what I hope to be able to do.
Now, Franz, I know that you were singing Baron Ox, which is a long, difficult role, when you were 23.
Get out.
Gosh. But maybe, was that an exception, or were you taking on the really strenuous parts pretty quickly?
Yeah. You know, the system in Germany is completely different than here. I was member of a little opera company in Coburg, Bavaria, 40,000 people city, and I had to sing it. Mm-hmm. They said, okay, you get a 2 years contract, this is your fee, and this is your parts. And if you don't do them, we take someone else. There are many people around. So I asked my teacher, Hans Hotter, and he said, yeah, look at it and we'll try to study it. And I did it and he said, that's perfect for you, do it. So I did it and it was terrible at the beginning. And it took me 5-6 years to learn it. But now it became one of my biggest parts and it made my living for a while. And it opened the doors to every big opera house in the world. So there's no plan, there's no system you can I am the opposite of hers. I'm more the kind of frisky. I just need the kick. I'm not one of these singers who sings five parts and that's it for his life. I just need new challenges, otherwise I get bored. And I think I'm an artist, and an artist has to spread his oeuvre as much as he can. So I think I've got 75 parts now, and that this is like now I'm getting there where I know something about opera.
Mm-hmm. Probably if you wanted to, both of you could sing heavy German operatic repertoire exclusively. So Christine, mm-hmm. after a strenuous role like this, or like Isolde or Brunhilde, or for you, Franz, after something like Zox,
Wotan,
do you try to follow it with something that is in every way a total change of pace?
Well, I do lots of recitals, and so I
so
really,
I.
yeah, I mean, I try to find things that will keep my voice fresh and keep my mind, you know, challenged. And
but it's also the way you sing it.
Yeah,
for example,
it is.
The way she sings this, it doesn't strain her voice.
No.
You know, some people have to go towards the boundaries of their vocal possibilities. She doesn't even touch it. So I think this is the good thing. If you do that, and Barak is like, you know, I could sing this four times in a row because it's just the best thing for my voice, which I can do. So you can't say Wotan is a difficult part. Of course, it's a long part, but some people... It suits to some people, and some people have to really work hard for it.
Yeah.
There are parts I have to work hard for, and many people say, huh, what? That's easy. Why? What are you worried about that there? So it's experience. It's like a sportsman. You just have to go to your boundaries and see where, or frontiers, you say.
Yeah, you know where your boundaries
are. And you see
are.
Where you get tired, or which hurts you, or which doesn't. So.
And also, I mean, I have to, for me... It has to be something that speaks to me. There are certain roles that I don't sing and certain repertoire I don't sing because it doesn't speak to me. And I don't think
and
that I can
in
make a
German
good
repertoire, there's big differences.
Yes.
Some roles speak to you, some
mm-hmm,
don't.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, can you imagine her singing Elsa, for example, with this silvery, glittery voice? Everyone would say, boah, what? That is a big, big, heavy voice for Elsa. Oh, no. It's perfect.
Mm-hmm.
It's perfect. You can't predict it. You have to listen to it. You have to go see it and go hear it.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to do it yourself. And then you can decide.
And you know. I mean, that's what I say to young singers when I'm doing a master class or something. I said, you know, you do know in your soul, in your gut. You can sort of figure out, you know what, that's not working for me. That is not.
And then you have to say no.
Then you say no. Yeah, because that's the danger. And I think especially for young singers who, you know, feel like, well, I've got to take every job that's offered. Well, no, you know, sometimes you better just, if it's going to be something that could ultimately hurt your voice or your career, then you say no.
Yeah, but it's only you, yourself,
right. That's
who
right.
can decide it.
Right.
As far as Die Frauenschatten is concerned, in conclusion, let's think about the man and woman on the street who don't know this piece necessarily and are curious, but they need a sort of lure. So if you were going to sum up the appeal of this piece for them and bring them into the theater, what do you think your sort of gut response would be?
Do you start?
Oh, I don't know. You can say.
I start the... So you have to experience the incredible sensation, erotic sensation of a wave of orchestra, a wave of sound, and a wave of big, warm voices come like a shower over you. That is the only thing I can tell you. And you'll never experience it in a piece like Fraunischat.
I second that. I mean, it's just... It's an experience for the senses. Yeah, yeah. It's amazing.
Well, I wish you both all the best with this new production of Fraunischat, and thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes at Lyric Opera of Chicago. Backstage at Lyric features interviews with the creative forces behind the productions in the 2007-2008 season. For additional interactive content and to order tickets, visit us online at lyricopera.org.